Disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed by the participants of this show are not the views. Opinions expressed by the participants of this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show.
Everybody, welcome to Ancast. I'm Zach Burchy. Justin is here.
Howdy.
How's it going, Justin?
It's been a week, but a good one.
Yeah, me too. Having a good time lately, but unfortunately not a lot of time for anime. I've only watched like one thing, but you got to a small stack of stuff, didn't you?
I did. I started, after everyone was, you know, peeing their pants over it, I blind bought the first two discs of Madoka Magica.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, they're right.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm a little surprised that you like this as much as it did, because the director, Akiyuki Shimbo, has such a ridiculously show-offy visual style. And I can never really tell if I like it or not.
I like it in this. Other shit that he's done really bothered me, like Arakawa Under the Bridge bothered me.
See, I thought it flowed better in Arakawa.
Oh yeah. See, I didn't like Arakawa. I didn't like the that the camera was doing these wild takes. I didn't like that. I thought it was jarring and weird, and didn't flow. But here, I think it works in the series' favor.
It leaves you feeling a little discordant and a little unsure of where things are.
Yeah, and that's kind of the whole point. Like, that entire show is just building and building and building this horrible tension. And everything in the show seems like that's what it's built to do, is to build that tension.
Right.
And it does a really good job.
Yeah. This is the most effective, interesting anime I've seen in probably a couple of years.
Yeah. I don't think I would even hesitate to say that. I think it's the best thing I've seen in, a good long time. It's been a while since we've had anything that special. And it's really... It's really, really special. It feels like I would draw parallels. Haven't seen the ending yet. I would draw parallels to Evangelion in terms of impact on the fandom, in terms of popularity, and certainly in terms of execution and quality. I mean, I would really put it up there. It's great stuff.
The one thing about this is I feel like I could show Evangelion to a non-anime fan and get something of an okay response.
Sure, you're right. You're absolutely right about that. I mean, I'm just saying in terms of like how I personally felt about it and just the impact it seems to be having. Because it's a lasting thing. This thing is still massively popular, and the movies are coming. So it seems like we just haven't had anything like this that's exciting like this in a really long time. You know.
Yeah, and I have to say the Blu-rays are gorgeous.
Yeah, they look really good.
They look really good, and this is the first Bang Zoom dub I've enjoyed in a long time.
Yeah, I agree. I think there are some quibbles here and there, but specifically, I can't remember the actress's name, but whoever they have doing QB does a very good job. That is a really good performance.
Oh yeah, that's really, really nuanced.
Yeah, and who'd have thought? Like that's like the hardest character to get right, I would imagine.
Yeah.
And just the tone, the line delivery is really good.
It's confident, but a little like you can't tell what's going on in that head.
Yeah, it's striking.
In that adorable little head.
Right. It's striking a very, very particular type of delivery that I would not to rag on Bang Zoom. I just wouldn't expect it from from them.
Yeah, they're kind of I consider them an 80% house. Like they do a good job 80% of the time, but whenever anything requires like going really the extra mile artistically, they fall down as much as they achieve it.
Yeah, and when it comes to anime dubs, really going the extra mile is another take. So it's nice to see something that feels like it a little more elbow grease when it went into it.
Yeah.
I mean, unfortunately, It was never going to escape this, but it is swimming in generic English anime girl voice. But there's no way they would have gotten around
yeah.
that.
Yeah, I mean, you cannot dub cute little girls without it sounding like that. I just don't think it's possible.
Yeah. So, but I'm glad you're joining. I'm really looking forward to the ending.
Me too. It ships next month, right?
Yeah, I think so. I hope so. That means I should get it. It means I should get it in a couple of weeks. So I'm excited about that. Yeah, I really, really want to see that. Aniplex has been nice enough to send the super deluxe packages. And one of them, the first one, came with a bumper sticker that is just QB's eyes. And I'm like, where am I going to put this? that's cool. I'm super glad you like it. I knew you would. Like, when I got like halfway through the second disc, I was like, Justin really should be watching this. Like, this is something else.
Well, it is a tale about children being traumatized.
I haven't seen the ending, but it is one of the most deeply bitter and cynical shows I think I've ever seen.
Oh, it is so upsetting.
Like, typing out, I remember writing that review, I had to write out what the show is trying to say about happiness and caring about other people. And when you get to that, you're like, oh, they're really arguing that that is the path to destruction. Like, giving a shit about anyone but yourself is a bad idea and will lead to your untimely demise. It's real dark shit. I can't wait for the ending, but cool.
Well, I saw two things. I saw live action wise Cabin in the Woods because too many people recommended it to me for me to ignore.
Yeah, it's fun.
That was fun. It was not at all what I was expecting. It's still a teen slasher movie, but it is so not a teen slasher movie.
Yeah, it's I liken it to a fun little short story. That's right. What it feels like, where you don't really see the end coming, like those Shaggy Dog stories that they used to write like in the 50s.
Right.
Yeah.
And I finally caved. I thought, you know, I need a big, long show just to lose myself in. Mm-hmm. And someone recommended me The West Wing.
Okay.
Which I'm like, well, yeah, I do like Aaron Sorkin. So, yeah, why have I never seen this? So I bought that giant brick. I found a great deal on it. Mm-hmm. And I started watching it. And I'm like, holy crap. How did I? Oh, yeah. That's why I didn't watch it originally, because my dad is a Republican and I was still living at home when that happened.
Oh.
So there was no way I could ever watch that in his house.
It is kind of, from what I understand, it is basically wank material for Democrats.
It is. But at the same time, it's clearly not any recent administration.
Yeah.
Like, it is clearly fantasy.
Yeah.
And the characters are really, really well fleshed out, and I really, if I were to wish for any superpower, it would be talking like an Aaron Sorkin character all the time.
But think of all the hallways you'd have to walk down.
I know. I would get so much exercise.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's, you know, his writing kind of reminds me of Paddy Chayefsky.
Yeah,
except not quite as literate.
A little bit. Yeah, it doesn't have that working class thing going on at all.
Right. not only working class, but it also doesn't quite send me to the dictionary as much.
Yeah, that's true.
Weird balance there. But no, the show is really good. It's really the characters are really rich and likable, and that's what makes a good show. So I guess I have to watch all 7 seasons now. Oh, darn.
Yeah, I think that might be next for me. I definitely need a show to dive into. I think I've gotten through just about everything else except for that. So
Bamboo's been trying to get me to watch Friday Night Lights, but after my sports anime bender, I think I'm done with sports fiction for a while.
I saw like 2 or 3 seasons of Friday Night Lights. Maybe I should finish that. It's good. You would like it. But yeah, if you need a break from sports, yeah, it's... Yeah.
Yeah, sports just reminds me of how much I hate most people.
Everything reminds you of how much you hate most people.
Touche.
Speaking of hating things, I tried to watch Fullmetal Alchemist, the Sacred Star of Milos, having heard nothing but good things. I really didn't hear anything except, why did they make this? And we know the answer to that. The answer is money.
Right.
But this is basically a Shonen Jump style movie where it takes place at some sort of unspecified place in the Brotherhood timeline, which I also haven't watched. I tried desperately to watch Brotherhood. I'll get to that in a minute. But so this is a side story where Ed and Al come across this like slum, and there's an alchemist there who has superpowers or whatever, and it's like there's sort of like an uprising going on from like the slums to the people in power at the, you know, in the aristocratic part of the city, and then I fell asleep. I don't know what it was. I only got about 30 minutes into it or so, and I was out like a light, and when I woke up, the menu was playing. And I said, you know, no, I don't care. I just can't do it. I don't give a shit. This is, you know, they start the film by saying like, yeah, let's go to this city and maybe we'll find out how to get some clues on how to get our bodies back. And it's like, well, so why don't you just rip any story tension out of this right away? Because we fucking know they're not going to learn anything about that. Nothing, no progress can be made on that story in this movie.
Right.
And frankly, if you already have seen the show or whatever, that's not that interesting anyway. Like, that shouldn't be story motivation for a show, for a movie coming out years after the fact. It needs something better than that. But, you know, I guess they can't work around in the fiction too much. But it immediately introduces dumb side character no one cares about that's clearly going to be the focus of the film. It has some interesting animation stuff going on. There's these, like, werewolf chimera things that don't look like they belong in the film. They're, like, animated very almost like psychedelically, like it's super weird. I don't know who directed this, but it doesn't look like a lot of other FMA stuff just in terms of side characters. And the animation seems a little loosey-goosey. It doesn't seem very tight. I haven't seen a lot of Bones' other theatrical productions, but there were wiggly lines and stuff happening in the animation you just wouldn't expect from an FMA thing. But after, you know, after I fell asleep and I woke up and I realized I could not possibly care less what happens in this movie, then I realized, oh, you know, I'm kind of done with Fullmetal Alchemist, period. Like, I don't want any more. Funimation just released the box set. They're now putting out Brotherhood in these big chunks. So it's like, I just got a box in the mail that has like 33 episodes in it. And I put that in and I skipped the first episode and I skipped the ones I had seen. So up through like 12. And then watched episode 13 and said, nope, don't care. This is like literally the fifth time I have tried to watch this. I don't want to watch this. I don't care. I'm over it. I loved that first TV show, but I don't want any more Fullmetal Alchemist. I am over it.
You know, I did the same thing. I've tried repeatedly to watch Brotherhood, and I've gotten with varying degrees of success, but never a degree more than like 8 or 9 episodes.
Yeah.
And I can't get into it. I can't get into it to save my life. Something about that series is not hooking me. And it's maybe I'm just done with that world. Maybe I just can't. Maybe the first series just put a neat little bow on it to the point that I don't care to go back and start from scratch again.
Yeah.
It's just I'm not engaging.
No. And why am I forcing myself at this point? Like, it's a long ass show and I clearly don't want to watch it. So I'm not going to. And you know, it kind of sucks too, because watching this movie, like there's a few moments of levity. It's all very serious. But there's a couple moments of levity and it's kind of the same jokes that they make, you know, the interplay between Ed and Al.
I am not sure.
Yeah. Shit like that. And I just kind of rolled my eyes and said, God, I think I'm done with this. Like, I don't care anymore. And you know, I love that first TV show. It's great. It's really, really great. And it ends really well. And it's kind of like, this is one of those cases where it's kind of like Arrested Development, which the fans of that show seem to think that they want more of it. I think they're going to find out they actually didn't want more of it. But it ended 3 seasons in. It had a good ending, and I'm done with it. I don't want more. I don't need to see more. It had a good run. 3 seasons is about as long as any sitcom stays good anyway.
Mm-hmm.
No need for more. Even though I love it, I don't necessarily want more of it. And Fullmetal Alchemist, I believe at this point, is definitely in that category for me of I really loved that. Do not make another second of animation because I don't want to see it.
Right.
But yeah, by all accounts, everything I've heard about this movie turned out to be true. Really mediocre, completely unengaging, and I put it out on Twitter that I was having a real hard time keeping my eyes open and got a bunch of messages back saying, haha, yeah, I totally fall asleep in the theater. It's like, oh man.
People were excited about this movie.
Well, and that's, isn't that kind of the letdown? Because I know that they're restrained by the fiction. I know that they can't go really crazy with it and change the ending of the story or whatever. But they don't, they have enough creative freedom to at least make it interesting?
Sort of side story that doesn't have to immediately address the central conceit of the show.
Yeah, or something like a side story that isn't just so pedestrian and meandering and just dull, just so boring. Ugh. And, you know, it was fucking action-packed, too. Like, the first 30 minutes, like, 15 minutes of that is just solid, non-stop action sequences that are pretty well animated. And I did not care. Just didn't care. So, yeah. Sacred Star of Milos. Ugh. I imagine that there are super diehard fans out there that totally loved it, and I'm glad that those voice actors got another round of work with those characters and everything, but I hope that they don't do another one of these. Please, no more. You've milked it.
Well, two seems to be the magic number of times that they can go back to the same well and tell the same story again.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, what's the other show that did that? I guess Inuyasha did that.
There are a couple of them. You could argue Dragon Ball.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know. Little disappointing, but at least, you know, coming to that realization, like, oh, I'm finished with this. It's good to know that, so I won't, like, force myself to watch future, whatever they do in the future. I can just say, like, yeah, I don't care. Okay, all right, well, let's go ahead and get to the guest. Okay, we're back. Our guest this week is, I think it's fair to call her a legend among anime fans in America, especially. It is director, producer, and artist Jan Scott Fraser. Jan, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Absolutely. Hello.
Justin, take it away.
So, sure. So, you've had such a long and industrious career, we have to just kind of start at the beginning just to get a footing.
Certainly. This year, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but this year is my silver anniversary of being in the anime industry. Kind of terrifying. I know. I started when I was two, so
when you were two.
Yeah, that's how I can be this young and still have worked in it for 25 years.
Fair enough. So, how did you get into anime in the first place?
Well, after I took a semester of college, then I came back home and I worked at different places like Radio Shack and Domino's Pizza and stuff like that. And I met these guys through some friends of mine from high school, and we used to do gaming. Used to game, like, you know, everything from D&D to, oh my God, Paranoia, to all these different, you know, dice games at that time. And one of their friends, this guy named John, brought over a tape of some, he goes, you got to watch this. This is Japanimation. And he put it in there. I didn't have a VCR, but we watched it there. And it was Macross, the TV series. And it blew my mind. I'm like, what is this? Just missiles and color and interesting characters. And when I was a little kid, I watched Johnny Quest. That was my show. And ever since then, I had searched for something like that. That's why I liked Tintin books and stuff. But I searched for something like that, and I found it in anime. So there you go.
So you just kind of caught the bug and just ran with it.
Yes.
Were you already an artist at that time?
I've been an artist since I was like a little kid. I like to draw and paint and build stuff out of cardboard. I used to make like little houses for my sister's Barbies, or well, I should say our Barbies. You know, stuff like that. So I've always been very creative in doing things. I used to write as well before that. But yeah, so. And anime hooked me, the colors and all. I'm like, I have to draw this. I have to paint this. So, yes, I'm sorry.
Well, so how did you make the jump from I really like this stuff to I want to work in this business and relocate to a different country?
One night, I became friends with John, and he and his roommate had a Laserdisc player. So we would go over there on the weekends and watch anime all night. And one midnight, he put in the second Urusei Yatsura movie, Beautiful Dreamer. when that put the hook in me, that was it for me. I was like, when I saw that, I said, if this is what they're making in Japan, I'm going to Japan because I want to make something like this. And from that moment on, it was a matter of, okay, well, how can I do this? And so I went on a tour there in 1986, the Japanimation 86 tour, the first tour of anime fans over there, 50 of us. I went on that, and then in that was like August, and that December, I found an ad in Anime Magazine that said, for the International Animation Institute, and at the very bottom it said, in English, teach Japanese, which is necessary to the foreign student. And I'm like, well, that's got to be good for me somehow. So with a friend of mine who's, you know, fluent Japanese, I contacted them and they sent me their art test and all that stuff. So, and they had a language school attached. So I sent my money and I got my visa and I went over there. Kind of, it's a little bit more complex than that, but basically that's what it was.
And it was just a whole, how big was the school?
Oh my, it was inside the Yamanote Loop. So it was downtown. It was, let's see, at that time it was four buildings, small buildings. They'd be like half of the building. So I'd say there were probably about 300 students in total. And there were about eight teachers in the animation and manga side.
So it was a pretty tiny class.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was very, I mean, the biggest class I had was the first year animation class. And there were, let's see, about 20, 40, about 60 people in there. And that was the biggest one. Other than that, like by the time anime has this tremendous attrition rate, it's actually worse than the SEALs, you know, 98%. And, so by the second year we had gone from 60 to like maybe a dozen. And that was obviously a smaller space. And then over the course of that time, it went to about four or so people. And yeah, it's not because it's not like the SEALs where you have to, you know, learn to lose your fear or jump from a helicopter or whatever. I mean, you have to do a lot of stuff you don't want to do. When you got into anime, you wanted to draw those characters you like. You didn't want to have to draw shoes and doorbells and clouds and stuff. So yeah, people go, well, this isn't fun.
So it was just all mechanical drawing mostly, not mechanical physically, but just like daily kind of drawing the stuff that no one really wants to, sort of thing. The grunt.
Yes.
Work.
Yeah. In many ways. One of the things, you know, of course we were learning, we would get the scenes from the teachers and we would do these scenes. And I don't know. I mean, ultimately it was like it was a trade school. It was teaching people how to work within that specific system. You know, how to do, and there's not just that. I also did cell painting in there and camera in there. And, all sorts of stuff in different things. Because when the president of the school asked me what I wanted to do, I had no idea. The first time I went there, I had no idea. I'm like, I wanted to be a character designer, I said. But then I had the tremendous lucky opportunity. When I moved there, I lived in this apartment building called Tama Esti. And it was run by this guy he was a Japanese guy, but he had studied in CU Boulder here in Colorado. So he, you know, spoke very fluent English. And so he and I got to talking and he says, well, I have a friend in the anime industry. He's a director. Let me take you to visit him. So he took me up and his friend Kanda-san, and who worked at this company, Visual 80. And at that time, Visual was doing Spiral Zone. And they were, what else were they doing? They were doing Orange Road. I mean, pieces of, obviously, of Orange Road and some other stuff.
A cooperating studio.
Yes. And so they said, yeah, well, come hang out with us. So basically I interned there. I love to spend time there. Obviously that's why I came. So I would sit with the directors, I'd sit with the cell painters, and I'd sit with the animators. It was funny because I sucked at animation so bad then, man. We had a really, really tough supervisor. And about 2 months into there, this American friend of mine, Ken McDonald, who was over there, he had moved there before I did. He was teaching English at the time. And so we got connected, he got into the school. And so, later on, I'm sorry. So he came to visual, and so we kind of interned together for a while. And man, our adventures were very interesting there. But so we would, he did the animation drawings, and I tried, but Sumio-san, man, he was too hard for me. So I did cell painting, and eventually we had this translator named Elaine, and she was kind of the assistant director on stuff. And we had this director from he's a French-Canadian guy, Pierre. He was the main director of Spiral Zone, and he came, and there were a lot of trouble. So sometimes he'd be in Korea, and sometimes he'd be in the U.S., and then she would be doing her own thing. So every so often, there'd be a space of, like, anywhere from a day to up to 6 days where there was nobody who was doing the job of the director. And so they told me, they said, hey, can you sit down and just listen to the English and make sure it matches the flaps, the mouth flaps? So I'm like, okay. So I did that. And when I was watching it, I saw, because I had, done cell painting and stuff, I saw these little mistakes here and there, little color pops and stuff. So I made notes. I'm like, here's where the English didn't fit. Yeah, the mouths, and here's other stuff here. I noticed a little color thing here, and I noticed this thing, and there was a weird cell here. And these guys are not going to like the way you drew this general character or this bad guy character. They're not going to like it. They're going to kick it back to you. And so when I gave them this list, they looked at it and they said, no one's ever done this. And so they were very excited. So that became kind of a regular thing for me. And they really liked what I did, and they were like, you're going to be a good director someday. So anyway, when that ended and I went back to the school and I went from I went from the language school to the animation school, he asked me again, what do you want to do? And I said, I'm told that I will be a good director. He says, okay. So he put me through everything. I went through every single department that the school had. Because, in both his and my opinion, a director should know everything. A director should have tasted every part of that before he or she can call a retake, choose things that are not going to make it financially or what have you. So got to be practical.
Right. Now, all this time, are you just total kid in a candy store, or are you just kind of freaked out by the – I mean – 80s in Japan was a very different place than it is today.
Oh, yes, very much so.
I imagine there had to be quite a bit of culture shock as well.
Yes, very much so. When I went, they lost my luggage, and I finally found this Tama Esti place, and I thought that the school had arranged a room for me, but they didn't. So I came there, and I thought, oh, there's a waiting list. I'm like, oh my God, I'm homeless in Japan. And so there were some really terrifying, that's when a guy, luckily here, there's that weird luck again, a guy came in and said that he was moving out the next week. And so they just put me at the very front of the waiting list. So I had to stay on a ryokan for 3 days, but I got a room. So there were some really terrifying moments. But then I'd go to like one of the anime stores, Animate or something, and it was like, finding heaven or something, because it was all there and it was on TV. And yeah, go ahead.
Dickensian almost.
Yeah, very much so. And there were, there were times when I would watch all the anime on TV. I would spend food money to rent videos and stuff. But sometimes I would just get so desperate to hear English that, I would watch like Chips, which had the two, Nikagogo, which is the two languages, the dual language, whatever. And I would switch it to English and I would just, hey, I don't care how horrible this is. And wow, like they had that and Airwolf and the A-Team and stuff. I'm like, these are not shows that I really like per se, but I watch them all. I can tell you all about them.
Yeah.
Combat and stuff. What was it? Surfside 6 and just all sorts of a weird melange of stuff. But
worst of times indeed.
Yeah, and then I could rent English movies, and I had just a few friends. I had Ken, and I had a couple friends from school, one of whom just wrote me about 3 months ago, weirdly, about 25 years later. I had a couple of them, but I didn't really see them very much. And then in my, when was that? My second year, I had a girlfriend. So, but, you know, it was just, I was alone the vast majority of the time. And that was very interesting. That was very, I really learned a lot about myself and what I wanted. And I learned a lot about, you know, I spent a lot of time in the language and a lot of time drawing and a lot of time learning every little thing. I like to hyper-focus on such things. And so, yeah, I consume it.
So you were, how long was this time all told that you were in school there?
About, well, let's see. I moved there in 87 in April, and then I switched in the animation school in October. And then that was 87, so I went through 88. And then I was supposed to graduate in, what was it, September of 89. But in December of 88, the president of the school hired me to teach cell painting. So then in January of that year, of the next year, January of 89, he sent me to China to teach animation. And I'm like, I can teach cell painting. He says, no, you teach animation. So, you know, as they say, there's no better way to learn something than to teach it. And then, oh my gosh, that was absolutely terrifying. And there I am in China, you know, which I never expected to go to. And I was just very alien to me. And at that time, China was very, very communist. And so it was weird. It was a very weird experience.
How long were you in China for?
I was, the first time I was there for a month. And then I went back. I would go back a little sporadically until the Tiananmen thing happened. And then I didn't go back for about a year after that. And then I've been to China a lot, all over the place, just mostly doing trainings. at first I would teach people to do cells. They'd hire me to come in and, you know, they would have hired a staff, and I'd say, okay, here's a cell, here's the sheet of acetate, here's how the trace machine works, here's how you, you know, use a pen to hand trace the cell, the shadow lines, let's call them that, on, and, you know, how to make sure you don't ruin the cell by scratching it, you know, just the entire process of cell painting. People used to hire me to go to their studios, so I went to all over China doing that, and one time, years later, I was teaching computer animation. I was teaching people how to use Animo and Photoshop, for that matter. And then I had a little bit of time and more money, so I had the opportunity to travel a little bit more. So I got to go to Tibet then. That was very exciting. So yeah, China's awesome.
So after school, you got a job at Artland. How did that happen?
After school, I went to work. I was hired by this company, Top Gun, who was a cell painting company, and they were the ones who sent me to China. And they would send me to China, and I would go to this studio in Hangzhou, and I would supervise the cells and supervise the animation. So, like, you know, I would do corrections, and then they would redo the drawings. So I would go for like a week, sometimes, you know, 2 days. And then I would bring, I would bring the work back to Japan after that. And, you know, I'd go back 2 weeks later, what have you. And then, like I said, when Tiananmen happened, that just shut all of that stuff down. And so after that, I had no job. And she says, I'm sorry, we're going to have to let you go. And so she introduced me to Ishiguro-san, Noboru Ishiguro, who the late... you know, when we talked and he asked me, what did I want to do? And I said, well, I'm told I'll be a good director. And I told him what I had studied. He says, okay. And he put me in the production department, which, oh, talk about the crucible. Oh my gosh. No foreigner had ever been in the production department, because you got to drive, you got to talk on the phone, you know, it's very tough. So yeah, he gave me that chance. That's what he did. He was a great man. Because of him doing that to not just me, but to so many people, that the industry flourished after that. I mean, the whole 90s were because of people he, you know, gave that opportunity to. So yeah, I'm very glad that I was a part of that. And so yeah, production. Oof.
So could you just describe for our audience that might not know what exactly happens in the production department?
Okay. Basically, I was the kind of the central management for the making of the animation show. So let's say a video, for instance. Let's pick, Rikkyo 2, which is just off the top of my head because I see the tape across the room. So with that, the director, Maijima-san, worked at another company called Magic Bus. And then the character designer, his name was Suda-san. He's one of the guys who did Fist of the North Star, Hokuto no Ken. He was very instrumental in that, a lot of toy animation. And he lived up in Saitama, which is very, very far north. And then the animation supervisor was at Artland. I can't remember his name. Can't remember his name, but he was in the office. And then like the color, ink and paint supervisor was also at Artland. The background, the art director, that was Buka. That was Nakano. So that was kind of downtown. So what I had to do is it was Takada no Baba, which is, I hope people understand, I know this means nothing to most people, but anyway, it was very, very, very downtown. And so I would have to drive there in streets that were like alleys, that were two-way streets. And so I would pick up, say, the key animation from Suda-san or from, wherever. From Magic Bus after the director looked at it. And then I would bring it back to Artland and the animation supervisor would do his corrections. And then sometimes they needed to have retakes, so I'd take them back to the other directors. Let me explain this process. I'm sorry, I'm kind of scattered here. You have the story, and then the story is made into the script. And then you have the storyboards, which come from that. In Japan, the director almost always does the storyboards. And that is that's an extremely important part of that process. And that's one of the reasons why anime is really amazing, is because the director or the animation supervisor or somebody in the middle of that process who continues to be instrumental for the rest of the whole process, doing those storyboards is crucial. Anyway, so they do the storyboards, then it goes to the chief director, then maybe an assistant director. You have the, and then the technical director, the enshitsu, who says, okay, we need to, the exposure sheet, time sheet has to be like this, and do the timing of this car like this, and you just, the technical director. And then it would go to the animation supervisor, who would check the drawings, and then off to the in-betweeners. And sometimes those would go to China, and sometimes they go to Korea, and sometimes it was different places in town. And then those would come back to Artland most of the time and be turned into cells by our ink and paint department, who would also farm out work to other studios, sometimes again in China. And, so this, it's a very, very distributed process. And once that's done, then it, of course, we take it to camera and the camera would shoot all that. Then we take that to the director. And then, of course, all the directors watch it and see if they're good with it, directors and supervisors. And if they are, then it goes to, well, I shouldn't say if they are. If most of it is, they go to dubbing, which is doing the sound effects. And then off-recall, which is the voice recording. And then it goes to out to the final product. And we watch it and we can check the final. Well, not the final. The last draft, as it were. We check that final draft. And if it's good, then there it goes off to, the client or TV or whatever. And so the production person is the glue between all of that. I would have to drive this to this and that over there, and I'd have to get on the train and take these backgrounds to these folks and call these guys on the phone and talk to those people. And then, and it wasn't just this, and that's just one show, and we were doing three at the same time.
So you're more or less kind of animation runner type?
Yes. Yes, because we had a very small production department there. It was just four of us. We did everything. So the animation runners, later on we did hire animation runners, a couple of them. And that's a bit more, because I did between animate the runner and the production desk, which is the person who is the management, not the production manager, because that's the whole overall project, but the manager of the production, that local production system. It's kind of hard to explain.
So granular. So,
yes.
So let's see. You did a whole bunch of shows while you were there. Any favorites stand out in your memory, or is it just this giant blur of, oh my God, I can't believe I survived that?
Yeah, it's a lot of that. Because honestly, when you're looking at it at that level, rather than, you know, like sitting down saying, oh, I like this show, you're looking at the various smallest pieces of it, which is fascinating to me. I mean, I love that. But there's not, I mean, that the fun and interest really goes out of it. And hopefully it's replaced with a different interest of the more technical and artistic side. Most people who go and work in the anime industry lose their fandom very quickly, or it's pushed out of them or yelled out of them by production managers, you know? So most people lose that. And a lot of people are really bitter after, Americans do the same thing. So it's not that, it's not the Japanese alone, but, and so people can become really bitter about that. And I was for years until I started, actually started producing before I started directing. So when I started producing, I started seeing that meta picture again, and then my love for the genre returned.
So there was kind of a period of burnout there.
Oh yes, very much so. Very much so. It was my job. And just like if you work at Starbucks, you know, you're like, it's my job, you know. I mean, obviously there are artisans who work there as well, but, you know, and that's what it was. It was like my job to do these boring things and, you know, whatever.
I often compare working in the anime business to having to eat your favorite food every day until you want to explode.
Yeah, you know, kind of. You know, actually, it's more like if there's your favorite food, like let's say your favorite meal, and then you get to have one part of it, but you have to take that completely apart and eat every little single part all the time. It's like, you know, if you got a bowl of cereal and you had to lay each little Cheerio or whatever out, count them, you know, write a little ledger, and then you got to, and then you had to eat them all back. That's kind of like the anime industry. Or the production department, at least, you know. Different departments have different cultures. They really do. They have, you know, like, you know, in-betweening is kind of very high turnover, whereas, you know, like the directors kind of get together in their group and they're more, you know, they're kind of, since they oversee everything, it's a more philosophical space. And the art directors, I mean, the background companies are very... Whereas anime companies tend to be kind of crushed, you know, people are very close together and they're in their headphones, and background companies have to have larger tables, obviously, to paint things. So, and they have to have a lot more ambient light, and light from windows and stuff, just so, you know, you get a better feeling. So it's so much nicer. It's like going on vacation, you know.
Comparatively.
I spent a year in a Toriebuka. And oh my God, I loved it. I was, you know, it was a very different atmosphere, and I loved working there.
So what got you into producing all of a sudden? It seems like a sudden jump.
Well, let's see. When I went to Artland, I did production, and then Artland conspired. Oh my God, that would be a great word. Artland went together with Kitty Films, who did like Ranma and Legend of Galactic Heroes and Urusei Yatsura and all that, with Kitty Film, and then Boot Systems, which is a Thai computer company, and to build an animation studio in Bangkok. And so Ishiguro goes, here, you, go do that. I'm like, okay, because, you know, I had taught a little bit in China before. It's kind of interesting because...
China, Bangkok, exactly the same.
Oh, yeah, so much. You know, I had never been there, and I was like, oh, okay. And, you know, we went once, and then I was going to go back for 2 weeks, you know, because we went once for a week, and that was very interesting because, you know, I had never been to Thailand. I was expecting China, and it was, oh man, you can't really compare these things, but it would be like expecting to go to, Maine and you go to like Alabama, which are, you know, very different climates, very different people, very different food and that kind of stuff, right? So, yeah, Thailand, it was like, I mean, it reminded me of Mexico City in many ways, Bangkok, the pollution-wise. And so here's a language I don't understand, a culture I don't understand. And, you know, obviously every culture has little picky things. Like in Thailand, you don't point your foot at anybody or touch anybody with your foot. And you don't touch anybody's head, you know. And there's body language you got to be careful of and... like any culture. So that was weird. But oh my God, when I got there, that food and the fruit, that owned me. I'm like, okay, I'll stay here. Tropical fruit. Oh geez. But, that first time they had interviews, with potential staff members, they had the space. So when we came, it was me and, Ishiguro and, I think the cell department chief. Anyway, we went. We helped them hire the staff. I mean, I had to sit there. He made me sit there through the entire thing. It was me and the Thai staff. I'm like, okay. So I get to pick all the staff. And I brought the designs for the desks, the animation desks, and we had to have all those made and the cell painting desks. We had to buy all the furniture. So, you know, obviously I was supervising all this while they're, you know, talking to the people and stuff. And so we got the furniture and we made sure we had, you know, I got a copier and all that, everything, phones, you know, because we started from scratch. We had an empty belt. We had an empty floor. So we filled it and I initially had 30 people. And I went back and I did 2 weeks of cell painting class. And the production manager, Bartland, this guy, Kakui, and I, we kind of butted heads from time to time because he had a very strong personality. He liked to yell at people, and I do not like being yelled at. I will stand up and turn and get very close in somebody's face. I'm not going to hit them, but I'll get very close in their space. And because I don't like it, I'll, you know. So he and I would really get into it sometimes. So one time he said, "You're going to run out of control. You're not going to be able to do this." And that was it. That touched me. I actually stood up for this one. And, it was very difficult. I had to stay in Japanese because if I went into English, you know, that goes, no, you can't do it. Right. So, that was tough. And we fought for like 20 minutes and everyone in Artland was just cringing. And Ishiguro came out of his office and he's like, "Shut up!" You know, he just made us shut up. And he's like, "You go sit over there and you go sit over there. And what's this about?" I'm like, he says like this and he goes, "Well, this is my choice and you just shut up, you know." So I wrote, I was like, "Really? Okay, I'll show you." So I wrote a textbook. It was like 3 weeks later that I went back. And so I sat at my desk and between, you know, calls and runs and stuff like that, I wrote a cell painting textbook. I took stuff from our cell painting department, like carbons, and I went and I found out, I did everything. I'm crazy. I found out the, you know, molecular formula for acrylic paint, and which allowed me to figure out something really interesting. When you look at a cell, you know how it's super bright and those colors are so vivid?
Right.
There's nothing that looks like a cell. The reason why is when you paint it on the back, you're painting it on this clear sheet, and the bottom of that, all those paint molecules are smashed against that. So when you turn it around, you get maximum light returning from it. So beautiful color. Isn't that interesting? When you look at a painting, it's all weird valley and hills and stuff. So anyway, back to Artland. Excuse me, I digress.
Interesting.
So I wrote this textbook and I went to Thailand and in 2 weeks I taught them. And at the end of those 2 weeks, Kakui came with the cell department chief and I heard them in the office because I was checking and see what happened. I want to make sure that however we need to retrain these people, because, you know, we will, however we need to do those, let's do this. About 3 or 4 hours later, that cell department guy goes back in there. He goes, "These people are better than ours. These people are better than our staff at Artland." I'm like, yes. Because if there's one thing I can do, it's train people, you know. I'm good at that, very good at teaching. So anyway, I did that, and I worked at that studio, and I ended up having to talk to a lot of other studios, and, you know, I met a lot of people in the industry, and ultimately that's what producing is about. Producing is about getting people, getting them together and making stuff happen and catalyzing it, you know, getting the director and just, and so, because I started meeting more people, and I really wanted to do this desperately. And so I ended up, people would say, okay, you know, here, yeah, we're going to go to such and such studio and let's pitch this, and, or such and such a sponsor and pitch this. So I'd be in the middle of it. And that's how I became a producer. And then also sometimes they'd have stuff coming in from the United States or wherever, England, whatever. And they'd say, well, you speak that language. So that's, you know, producing is a very amorphous term of being a producer.
Yeah, it seems to be one of those things that could mean a really important person, but almost anyone right. can get away with calling themselves that.
Absolutely. It's funny. We actually, Kakui was asking me, because we were looking at this list of credits for some movie, and he said, what do all these producers do? There's an assistant producer, and there's an executive producer, and there's, I'm like, see, that's, for every one of these, it's different. He goes, so you could just name yourself like the grand touring producer. I'm like, yes, you could. He goes, I'm going to do that. I am going to be the grand touring producer.
I got to remember that. So that was, place in Bangkok, that was TAO yes. Corporation?
That was CAB. I'm sorry.
Oh, that was CAB.
That was CAB, Kitty Artland Boot. And then that was in 1990. And then in 91, the latter part of 91, I left there, went back to Artland, and I became the sales department chief there to fill that, because their chief had left. And there was just this vacuum. So I was sent in to fill the vacuum for a while. And then after that, I was hired by a couple studios in China to go and do my teaching cell painting thing there. And I did that on and off for a while. And then Ishiguro and I got to talking, and we said, well, why are we building a studio with these other people? Because that was really what it came down to, is just the clash of management ideologies between myself and Boot Systems was very hard. And so we, you know, I went back to Japan. I'm like, this is, and they sent other people after that. And, so he's like, well, why are we doing this? Let's do it ourselves. So we decided, the two of us, to build a studio in somewhere in Southeast Asia. And, so this was started in 92. We started this process. So we went to Thailand, we went to Cambodia, and we went to Malaysia and Singapore. Oh, no, I'm sorry, not Singapore. We went to Malaysia and Indonesia.
Too expensive from Singapore, I'm guessing.
Well, yeah, they're just, you'd have to live there and know it really well because it's so small to be able to build a studio there. Plus, it would be very expensive. Right. Much higher standard of living. I hate to say it that way, but, you know, subcontracting.
One is a third world country and one is not.
I'm sorry?
I said if one of these is a third world country and one is not.
Yeah, well, yeah, you know, it's just, well, the thing is, people are paid at very different rates and shipping stuff and all. It's so anyway, we... he wanted Indonesia. I wanted Cambodia. So we ended up, because I had the connections in Thailand, I decided, well, let's do it here. CAB was just about, they were just about out when I came in and built my studio. So I bought all of their paint. I bought a ton of their desks. I basically bought my whole studio, with the exception of my background part. I bought my whole animation and cell department and stuff from them as they were going out of business. I also got a bunch of my old staff back, who had obviously had another year of, or 2 years of training, which was awesome. And I was very happy. I was so sad I had to turn some way because I had 50 people. I'm like, you know, I can barely fit them in my building. And so I had a cell department, and I had an animation department, and I had a background department. And then I had a little, it was just me, and I had a production manager, and I had my office manager and me. That was Tao, T-A-O, and that was out by the airport, and we did work. Well, obviously, I trained all the background people, and We did work for Artland primarily, but also Atelier Buka and AIC. We worked on Moldiver and what was it, Kichin Heidan and something Tenchi, just a little bit of it, nothing really important. Yeah, we did quite a bit of Moldiver, and then we did all the backgrounds for Geno Cyber 2 and 3, some yeah, for all for 2 and 3. And the art director who was doing that, well, Ohata, the director who did, you know, oh my God, like all sorts of stuff like the Guyver and stuff like that. I don't think he directed the Guyver.
No.
MD Geist, etc. I don't remember.
Genocyber.
Yeah, Genocyber, MD Geist, and a variety of other things. Right. Anyway, he came to my studio, and Kamiyama-san, who is now all super famous as a director, which makes me very, very happy. He came and, you know, worked with my staff, and he taught my staff a good deal. So I'd have, you know, clients coming in, and then I did a little bit of work, through Disney Japan. We worked on, Darkwing Duck, was it? Yes, I think. And then we did some backgrounds for SWAT Cats and, oh my gosh. What was the other thing? Yawara, I think it was. You know, when you have so much work going through, it's just, it becomes money, you know?
Right.
I hate to say that, but I'll tell you what, though, my background people hated working on American shows. They were like, no, get more Japanese shows. Don't get the American shows. And the reason why is because when you look at a Japanese layout, unless it's a movie, unless it's really has to be detailed, like a TV show, it'll be rough. So it's like, you know the colors you can work in. It's like, there's a tree here and this. So it's very artistic. You get to sit there and make your own tree and make your own clouds. And, you know, as long as it fits in the style of everything else and it has the same colors, you're good. And so that's, needless to say, very creative. It's also lighter washes, and you're working with watercolor and all sorts of brushes.
Right. Half the time those TV shows, it's just watercolor backgrounds, just kind of blurs.
Yeah, the bokeh and the like the speed lines and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, totally. So, but on an American show, they're all very defined. I mean, you have specific lines you have to follow. So you put the layout on a copy of the layout on top, and you take like a compass or something and you groove them into the paper. And then you use that as the guide, and you have to make sure your colors fade correctly. And there's a lot of airbrush. Well, there was at that time, a lot of airbrush. And so it took forever to do those backwards. I mean, I made a lot more. We made like four to six times what we made with the Japanese backgrounds, but my staff, they felt it was mechanical. So, cause they were painting inside shapes like paint by number. Yeah.
Did you have to learn Thai, by the way?
I tried really hard. I had a decent working knowledge of it. When I first went there, they hired a woman to be the translator and office manager, who later became my translator and office manager, Ms. Subarat, who's all on my Facebook, interestingly enough. they hired her, and then I worked through her, and then I did my best to learn everything I could, because, you know, I wanted to work directly with the staff, of course. And so I didn't study in school. I studied on my own, and they helped teach me. And when I went back, you know, I tried. I learned the alphabet that I knew for a while. I don't remember anymore. But so I had a decent working knowledge of it. Same with Chinese. I had a decent working knowledge of Mandarin.
So, what happened, how long were you at, TAO?
Let's see, I was there, I had that for about 4.5 years. And in the middle of that process, cell painting became really expensive. The price that we got paid for it was very low, but the materials cost was really crazy, because I had to bring all the paint from Japan. We had to get acetate from Japan. It had to be hole punched in Japan. You know, and just bringing that to Thailand, it just became more and more expensive, and everyone wanted to pay less. So we had to get animation work and cell work to pay for cell work. It was ridiculous. So I started looking into digital systems, into computer systems for doing this. And that time, you know, Photoshop 1 or something was out, you know, it was barely,
yeah, mid-90s, we're not ready.
Yeah, it was, I mean, Silicon Graphics was the thing, but, you know, we couldn't afford the $45,000 or $30,000 Silicon Graphics machines, you know, each. But you know, I through Anime Expo, interestingly enough, I got connected to a friend of mine, Leo, who was working at Next Computer at the time, you know, Steve Jobs Next. And he was a huge anime fan, and there were a bunch of other people. So we got to talking and about making a system to do this. And, you know, it really evolved. And then eventually we connected with this company in Cambridge, England, Cambridge Animation Systems, who had made this system called Animo. It was all vector-based, really advanced stuff. But it couldn't be used for TV because it was so advanced. You know, you had to really... I mean, the two-week intensive training program was not enough. And so we helped them design a system that could be used on TV where you would scan the drawings in and you could paint the drawings and sometimes automatically paint the drawings. And, you know, it would remove cell paint, just that whole thing. And you could send it straight to compositing software where you could put it on, you scan in the background, you put it there and you can, you know, do all your effects on it. And so instant retakes, that's like heaven. And so, you know, we realized that we needed to make this transition. So anyway, and I eventually went to work for the Animo people for Cambridge Animation Systems. At the same time, I was in Japan working on various animation things. And I also, until, what was that, 95? In 95, I started doing my own manga as well in the middle of all that. Yeah, I never sleep.
I was going to say, were you bored?
No, I never do any. Most people are like, yeah, I traveled. I'm like, no, I did this. You know, I'm like the Terminator. This is all she does. Yeah. So, you know, and I'm very, very multitasking. I learn extremely fast. I produce extremely quickly. And so I was doing my manga with Izumi Matsumoto, who created Orange Road. We were partnering in a digital manga company. And so anyway, so I had all this digital stuff going on at that time. And I worked for Cambridge as a consultant. And they started sending me to all manner of places. Oh, my God, they sent me everywhere. China, obviously, a bunch of times. Hong Kong, Taiwan. Let's see, Thailand. Singapore. I spent a lot of time in Singapore. South Korea, Indonesia, Malaysia. India, Bangladesh, the U.S., Canada, Mexico. They sent me everywhere. Amsterdam, you know. So I really got to see and meet a lot of people. And in that process, I started seeing how everybody sees animation. You know, what's important to it on a global or meta level. And I started thinking, you know, what could I make to address that? That would be interesting to that. And so that's when I started doing Kikaku, which is planning. And planning is where, let's just say, like, for instance, you have a novel. Like, let's say you want to make an anime of The Hunger Games, for instance. Mm-hmm. So you take the novel and you say, okay, we have this novel. How do we make this into animation? So you hire a planning person. And the planning person takes the novel and says, okay, gets a writer or writes it. In my case, I would write it. Gets a writer, gets a director, gets an art director, and puts this little team together to make a 3-minute pilot or, whatever, 2 minutes, whatever you're going to do. And then they take that pilot and sell it around. So, you know, when investors say, oh, yeah, we want to, you know, put money into the Hunger Games anime, you know, so they'll do it. And then that money helps produce the actual series. So that's what I used to do. I used to make pilots and stuff for people, which is awesome because you get this. It's super creative, super condensed, and, you know, everything is controlled. It's talk about micromanaging. I loved that, and I was extremely good at that. The problem is when the economy goes bad, they want to remake stuff. They want to make part two and part three and you know, episode or you know, the spin-off and stuff. And that goes to the same people who made it. So people like me, it work just dried up in 99. So, yeah, I mean, I did a lot of stuff. I also, through that process, I was also directing stuff. I mean, I directed episodes of, like, Susie Chan and Marvy for NHK, for, just bringing that all the way around, interestingly, Top Gun, the company that I went to China for, became Studio, Studio Pocket, let's call them that. So they hunted me down and hired me as a director. I'm like, that's awesome. So I directed for them. I directed for IG. I worked as a technical director for Production IG on, some games and then some
is
animated.
All video game work for Production IG?
Initially, yes. Panzer Dragon was one of the games we did. I didn't do much. I did a bunch on that. Darn it, what's the name of that darn thing? Sakura Wars, Sakura Taisen 2, and the Ghost in the Shell game, a PlayStation game, and oh, darn it, there's one other.
Basically all those big PS1 era cutscene games.
Yes. So that kind of stuff. We did a bunch of those. And so I directed, and then I also, my first real directing job was on a video game opening for a Windows platform called Mado Monogatari. It's, you know, Puyo Puyo. It's in that world. Oh. And you know, it was, I talk about lucking out. So my first directing gig, we had just finished Ghost in the Shell. We're not quite working on Blood as far as, you know, key animation and stuff. So our animators and stuff are kind of doing this and that. So he says, well, the president of IG goes, hey, just, you know, let's put a team together. I'm like, okay. So I got this amazing character designer and animation supervisor. She did like Ruin Explorers and stuff, you know, really great characters for this. I'm trying to remember other. She had worked on like all sorts of cute stuff. And then I had Ogura-san did my backgrounds, and he was like the guy who did like Pat Labor and Ghost in the Shell and Jinro, and like he's one of the best background painters in the world. And I had one animator, one key animator, and then four in-betweeners, I think it was. And my key animator was the third best animator in the country. He was like, I'm going to take time off. Oh, hey, this is cute. Can I draw some of this? I'm like, yeah, sure. And he ends up drawing the whole thing. It was freaking awesome.
Puyo Puyo opening.
Yeah, all for this Mother Monogatari. And man, I pushed Animo past its limits on this. It was amazing. we were watching it and we're like, holy crap, this is like a movie. It was amazing. So yeah, my directorial debut was fantastic. You know, and the thing is, somewhere I have a tape of it, but I don't know where. Yeah, for a Windows game that doesn't even work on anything anymore. Technology, darn you. You know, it's funny, when we made our manga comic on, and we released it on CD-ROM initially. And the thing is, we did it in Macromedia Director, and we can't read, no computer will play the files anymore. So when I saw Matsumoto and Maeda-san, our producer from that time, from Toshibi EMI, I saw them at Katsucon this year, they were showing stuff from it. I'm like, what's that? They go, no, we just shot it on video. We played it on the one computer that they had kept that could play it, and then they just videotaped, or they videoed the screen.
Oh, jeez.
I'm like, I hate technology sometimes.
This is why we have this is why we have emulators.
Yeah, really. Oh, man. Yeah, but the thing was, that darn director, it would copy a file to your Windows directory. It had, you know, its own little DLL thing, and we actually had to write the software to be another. Oh, it's only, you know, a little batch program. We had to write that to do that. So when you plug this in, here it is on your Windows 7 machine. It tries to install that file in Windows 7. And it's, what are you doing?
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, so you also ended up working on Retas Pro, right? Which is,
yes.
For those who don't know, that's the industry standard now that everyone uses for cell animation.
In Japan, yes.
In Japan.
And there's a number of companies who use it here, too. Retas was my competitor. Well, they were our competitor for Animo. And the thing is, see, in Japan, especially in the anime, if anything related to the anime industry, there's competition, but it's not really like, oh, I'm better than you. There's none of that. It's like, yeah, I'll do your work. Sure. So When I was working for the animal people, the Rathaus guys, because they became my friends, I would see them at trade shows and stuff. I'm like, what's up, boys? You know? And so I would do my thing, and then I'd go hang out with them, too. And then I would actually, and then the Sheldon Linker from Linker Systems and his wife, and I would hang out with them, you know. I mean, yes, they're the competition, but, you know, really, we're all different. There were a couple people, one company whose name I will not mention because they're the last man standing. They were not cool people. They were really dicks about everything. So we didn't hang with them. But so I knew the Redfest guys. And they called me. They're like, hey, that was my last year of consulting for Animo. And they said, hey, will you translate our manuals in English? I'm like, sure. So I translated all of their user manuals into English. It's different there. And so through that, I got to know them. I got to know the president pretty well. And so my job at Animo, that ended. They got rid of all their consultants, and I worked for a couple different companies after that. I worked for Stagio Polke, and I worked for EG Film. That was my last the last place I worked doing anime was EG Film. We were working on this show called Inspector Fable, and they did Slayers and a bunch of other stuff like that. But I worked there for a few months, and then just everything kind of my whole life exploded and melted down over the course of about 6 months. I went from, ooh, everything's not too bad, but it's going to get tough, to almost homelessness. Just two bags and moving back to America in the space of 6 months. It was just a freaking disaster. The industry was collapsing. Just my marriage exploded. Everything, and it's just the perfect storm. And in that time, I said, you know, I knew that anime, I knew that animation would be really difficult. If I wanted to get a job, I'd have to move back to the U.S. and hunt for one. So I went to the Redfest people and I said, hey, man, you know, I know you need help in the States, and I'll do it. But I'm going to be looking for this too. And they're like, oh, yeah, totally. So they hired me. And then I moved to L.A., the West Side. And
it's not so bad.
Oh, the West Side. So, are you kidding?
I'm sorry. I hate the West Side.
Are you kidding? My office was in Beverly Hills. It was a home office. So I stayed in this room, and every afternoon after I finished my work, I would go out. I would watch the beautiful sunset and the palm trees. I'm like, oh my God, it's another perfect day. And then I realized I was in like this Logan's Run climate control dome where everyone tries to stay young, but it doesn't work.
Yeah, I try to explain to people that aren't from here, the closer you get to the coast, the shittier the people.
Oh, man. So, I lived at La Cienega and Melrose. My apartment was there. So it was fantastic for me. And I walked all over there, the company where I worked was at La Cienega and Pico.
Okay.
It was Pico. So it was very close. It was like a mile away. That was right behind the Curry House and the Stinking Rose, right behind the Stinking Rose. Anyway. I lived there for a while. I got my apartment there, and I tried so hard to get animation jobs, but you know, animation experience in Japan means nothing in the United States. So, yeah.
So that have you gone back to Japan and tried to rejoin over there, or is it just not happening?
In 98, when the anime industry started really hitting the skids, I looked at it and I saw off on the horizon, I saw the disaster looming. And I said, you know, I need to get out of this. Not just the whole industry, but I need to get out of what I was doing, because I knew I would be starving. So I was already starving as it was at that time. And when I left for a few years, the industry just collapsed in on itself like a big black hole. A lot of people I knew, a lot of great directors and character designers, and well, not so much character designers, but great producers went to the games industry. And then I knew a lot of really talented people who left anime and went and drove trucks and, you know, went to office work and just completely left the whole process. It was a huge shaking out, huge. And so I'm glad I wasn't there. I'm glad I was at the beginning of that. And, you know, the foreigners, you know, are going to get shaken out first. I hate to say that. But then things kind of bounce back. Then, you know, more people, then the industry kind of realigned itself. And by that time, I was kind of on a different path. I was on the path of teaching art. I love teaching art, you know, and I love speaking at conventions and other, you know, and other schools and things like that. And so I kind of, my life shifted, and my life shifted into doing my own things, and music and such. So
it sounds like teaching has always been your something you've been good at.
Yeah, it's something I've just, it's very natural to me, and people seek me out all the time for it. So yeah, totally, totally.
Cool. Do you, so now you go to a lot of conventions, any that, you frequent that you, always do workshops in as a matter of course?
I do my workshops, my art and creativity workshop in almost every con I go to. What I do at cons is about a 2-hour session, and I talk about creativity and the roots of where that comes from, and, you know, what is art and how to see things and as an artist sees them. For instance, one of the things I talk about is when Gertrude Stein interviewed Henri Matisse, the painter, about his art, she asked him if he saw tomatoes in it. When he ate a tomato, did he see it in a different way than other people? And he replied that when he ate it, he saw it as a tomato, but when he painted it, he saw it completely differently. And so we discuss that kind of stuff and talk about, I have a whole section talking about how you don't need to spend your money on the best tools. And I have a lot of examples about people who use everything from Bic ball, blue ballpoint pens to make magnificent art. And I talk about composition, you know, framing, and I talk about writing, about how to write, how to sell things to some degree. So I don't say, here's how to draw an anime eye, because anybody could do that. I mean, I say, here's where the concept of your eye can come from. And no one's ever done that. And that's good stuff. I have a 6-hour version of that that is out in the world, out in the regular non-anime stuff. That's its own workshop that has drawing practice and a little bit of writing and a little bit of performing and stuff. It's that one's pretty wild, so...
And what conventions do you
frequent? Oh, I'm sorry. I go to, let's see, this year I went to Katsucon, and I'm going to the Nauticon in Cape Cod in 2 weeks. I'm going to JFAX. I go to JFAX. I've been there for quite a few years in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Really neat event. And then I have Akitacon in Thunder Bay, Ontario, which I love, of course. NondesCon, which is here in Denver, so I, needless to say, I go to the Denver cons, NondesCon, and Anime Land Wasabi. Oh yeah, I forgot Wasabi. Jeez. And then I also am going to Cincinnati for SugoiCon, which I've been going there for many years as well. And NecoCon has invited me, which will be in Hampton, Virginia, Hampton Road, or near Norfolk, Virginia, in November. So yeah, of those, I used to go to ACON a lot, but I haven't in the past few years. I went to both OhioCon and Anime Central for 10 years in a row. And then, I've been to slightly over 250 cons, anime cons.
You must be really sick of teenagers screaming internet memes.
You know, there was a time when there was this space, because at first it was like 20-year-old guys, you know, that was the world, and 20 to like 40-year-old guys. And then that kind of changed, and they started getting younger, and then, you know, like Robotech would bring more people, and then Sailor Moon happened and women appeared, you know, and that was different. And then, so yeah, the teenage thing started more, the more it was on TV, the more teenagers came, but at first it was all the nerd teenagers, so there was very little screaming. And then for lack of a better term, mainstream, the audience becomes, the more the screaming, the graffiti, the beating, the drugs, all that kind of stuff kind of comes with it. But, you know, it's all good. It's all good.
So are you still consider yourself a fan? Do you watch current stuff? And how has your experiences affected what you consume now?
My experiences have made me quite the connoisseur, needless to say. There's things that I'm willing, I'm picky about what it looks like, of course. I'm picky about what it sounds like. I'm picky about how it's made and what the message is. So, sometimes I'll have like animation on behind me, like Family Guy or whatever, that kind of stuff. And that's more a joke track than it is anything, you know? So, I watch that stuff on and off, but, I try to watch movies like, when Ghibli releases a movie or when Otomo releases a movie or when anything, you know, that's really kind of an upper level sort of thing. When those come out, I definitely try to watch them. And people, you know, most of the anime that I watch comes from my friends' recommendations. They'll say, "Oh, wow, have you seen, you know, such and such?" I'm like, "No, I haven't." And, so, you know, they'll loan me a DVD or something. So, I haven't, honestly, as far as keeping up with the news of what's new, I am generally aware, and I know what's coming out in the U.S., because, I see people at cons, and I talk to my actor friends and director friends, although I don't sit down and seek it out. I don't really often, watch anime on TV, for instance. I do watch anime that I, from old times, sometimes, we just see out through. I get together with some friends and we watch some old anime, Naushka, and all that, you know, so.
So it's more about the people connections at this point for you.
Yeah, it really is, you know, because it's not something that I really watch a lot. I mean, when I'm sitting alone, I either have the TV droning on while I'm looking at the internet or doing some art or something. Or I'm watching documentaries or something that really has to engage me. But as far as animation goes, I'm not the biggest fan of like Ice Age type animation.
Right.
It's not my thing. However, like the Fantastic Mr. Fox, I love that movie. That one just all together came out fantastically for me, and the Wallace and Gromit movies. So I love everything. I mean, animation in general, I like. So
sounds like you're more into the high art type stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. But, absolutely.
That's interesting. So just to wrap up, I was just looking at your website and your frequently asked questions. And I had to snark a little bit at the number of questions of, "I have this. Will you do this for me?" No.
Oh, God. At cons, that used to be constant. People would go, they'd get hold of one of my cards and say, "Oh, yes." And people would, they're like, "Hey, let me take you out to lunch." One time I went to AWA and this woman contacted me before and she's like, "I want this thing. I'm going to pitch you something." I'm like, "Okay," you know, and man, people, they would have everything. And I'm like, "I can't help you get this made. I can't help." And I got so tired of sending the form letter that I'm like, "Here, read my website."
You know, I've gotten those as well, and it's amazing just how indescribably terrible so many of those ideas are.
Oh my God. You know, some of them are like, "Wow, that's really clever." But some of them you just like, "Oh my God, if they made this, I think the world would explode," you know? Yes, very much so. And honestly, the biggest thing, the biggest reason for all of that is even if somebody has a good idea, they expect somebody else to pay for it. And that's not the way it works. Somebody has to pay for it, which means that somebody has to find those people to pay for it. And the people who pay for it, they get the power. They own it. They get releasing or whatever. You know, they have that major power. So when I show up with my idea, you know, I'm going to be a drop in the bucket of what that final thing is going to be if it's an animation show. But people just don't really recognize that when they, you know, aren't really that familiar with the industry. They think that, you know, they're going to be part of the process and all that stuff, which, you know, even if somebody picks it up, they're going to be like, "Here's a retainer, see it." And it's not like, it's not like IG is going to pay to make Joe Blow's, you know, fusion of Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball, you know, with Naruto spiced on the top, you know.
God, I wonder how many times does that come up?
And the other thing is, and I used to tell people, and someone, it's 70% true, is we had a filing cabinet in IG that was full of amazing story ideas. There was shit from Miyazaki in there. There was stuff from Oshimamaru. There's brilliant creators had ideas that ended up in that thing. And so, now granted, when new ideas would come in, sometimes they would often get fast-tracked. over those. But when people would come to me, I'm like, you know what? Yours is going in the file cabinet, and I'm sorry, but theirs has way priority. So, yeah, I mean, it was – I didn't want to completely discourage people, but I'm not the one to talk to is what that's about. I'm not going to make your show.
And frankly, that person doesn't exist.
I certainly have never met one that you can just walk up to and go, hey, man, I got this idea. You know, oh, my God. I've pitched TV shows. I've written a couple. And pitching them, oh, my God, what a brutal experience. In Japan, it's one thing. But pitching them here is like, you want to learn condescension and hatred. You know, you want to have doors slammed in your face. And people, in the mid-sentence, realizing what you're doing, you're talking about, then they'll turn and walk away.
God.
Yeah. So needless to say, I never got my show made here, you know.
Right.
The thing is, but since that time, like I said, it's not, I mean, obviously I do, I still translate manga. I still draw a little bit. I do all sorts of art, acrylic paint, polymer clay, music. I made, I founded a charity called Voices 4. We have some great musicians, and we had a bunch of the popular anime voice actors, you know, like Greg Ayers and Jamie McGonigal and Chris Ayers and Chris Patton and, a lot of folks, Mike McFarland. And we got together and we made these albums of cover songs, except Vic Mignogna did an original on our second album. And once we got our expenses out of the way, the rest is donated to partner charities for each one. Like, for instance, our first one was CARE and Doctors Without Borders. So, yeah, pretty groovy.
Awesome stuff. Zach, you want to get to Twitter?
Sure. We got some questions from your fans on Twitter. Just a few here. ABCB Tom. Firstly, wants to know if it's okay for him to request a story. He's asking that since the new loop on the third is out, he wants to know if you could possibly tell the Monkey Punch meets a guy from Mad Magazine story.
I guess yes. Referring to something. Okay. All right. I can do that. oh, my God. What year was that? I want to say it was 96. I was a guest at San Diego Comic-Con, which, you know, whatever the name of this now, I'm using the terms of them. I was a guest at San Diego Comic-Con, and I was doing, you know, my own panels on stuff, mostly animation production and such. And they asked me, the Comic-Con staff said, hey, Monkey Punch is doing, I was on his panel. I was on this manga panel with him as a manga artist, and they said, his translator isn't going to show up, so can you translate? And to be honest, I was mad because if I'm translating, I'm not on the panel. Because I'm like, he said this, and then I said this. Because normally if he has a translator, the translator will translate what I'm saying and the other panelists are saying too. So I'm like, oh, great. And it's just me and him. So I'm like, well, okay, I'm Monkey Punch's translator, fine. I mean, he's a super famous dude. He created Lupin the Third. He's a sweet little man. Anyway, so right before we started, they came back, the live events guy, Josh, came back in. And he says, hey, afterwards, hold him here. We have a present for him. I'm like, okay, whatever. So we went through we went through the panel. It was really interesting, actually. The audience asked him about where his inspiration came from. And he said that it came from Mort Drucker, the artist, from Mad Magazine. I didn't actually understand he was talking about Mad Magazine because he was saying Mado, Mado, and I thought Mado is window. You know, I'm like, oh, no, Mad, oh, duh. Anyway, so Mort Drucker, and, you know, I had seen his art millions and millions of times through the years because I used to read Mad and Craft and all. And I thought, okay, and so what he would do is he would take Mort Drucker's art, he would take his Mad Magazines, and he would lay them out in a fan around him, and he would just soak it up. Just surrounded by Mort's art, he would draw Lupin, and that's where the whole, his art style and everything came from. And he had always hoped he could meet him. That was one of his life goals. So he went to New York City when the yen was like 300 yen to the dollar. He spent everything he had, flew to New York City, went to the offices of Mad Magazine, the editorial offices, that he saw in Mad, and he said, hi, I'm here, I'm here, Sato-san, and I am here to meet Mort Drucker. And they said, he lives in Florida. And so, crushed and defeated, Monkey Punch got back on that plane and flew back to Japan. And he would go to Comic-Con, and Moore used to show up at Comic-Con sometimes. But he always missed him. He never got to meet him. So, you know, he was hoping to do that. And so, anyway, other people were talking, and they asked about, like, Castle Cog the Roadster, and I did not know that Monkey Punch didn't like it. I was like, really? Creator of Lupin did not like Miyazaki's take on it. So, anyway, we talked about that, and we talked about, like, the TV show, you know, how much did he have influence, and that kind of stuff. So, anyway, at the end of the panel, we walked down, and the Comic-Con live event staff came in, and they said, hey, you know, you've come here many times, and you have, Monkey Punch, and you have done such great things for the industry. We have a present for you. Meet Mort Drucker. And so there I was, being the interpreter between Mort Drucker, who I'd never met, and Monkey Punch, who this is one of the greatest moments in his life. And he burst into tears, and Mort kind of got misty, and I was trying not to have my voice crack in the middle of this. It was an extremely moving experience. And so, you know, and I was able, he said, you know, I have always wanted to meet you. It's been, and Mort's like, yeah, Mort's this awesome guy, by the way. Mort's like, oh, okay. He says, you know, come to Florida, stay in my house. Yeah. And his wife goes, yeah, you too. And she points at me, you know, and there were just these really sweet people, and it was fantastic. So, you know, they swapped business cards, and they're going to send each other sketches. And I was just, it was really, really fantastic. And I think, when it comes down to interpreting, you know, I am not a great interpreter, and I'm not a great translator. I'm good, but I'm not great. But that was my moment. That was my ultimate interpreting moment. Yeah.
Okay. Similarly, Manime Podcast asks, what are these wacky stories about Koichi Ohada during the production of Genocyber that you've hinted at in the past?
I want to know that.
Well, when they were making Genocyber 1, where did we meet? My God, I don't remember where. Oh, it was at Artland. I met Ohata, and he and I just really hit it off. We got to talk about monster movies and horror movies. You know, he's really into that. And he was really interested in some stuff. So he would ask me stuff about, okay, if an American character in this would be like, and he loved American movies. And so we just hit it off as friends, and I would sit in the office and hang out with him, and he would complain about that show because, yeah, well, it's so many years later, no one's going to give a shit, but, excuse me, no one's going to care anymore. But, you know, Genocyber 1 was made for $35,000.
What?
Well, okay, to put that into context, an episode of Cowboy Bebop costed $250,000, and an episode of The Simpsons is $1.4 million, because, you know, it's all voice, and it's like, so, yeah, right, you know? $35,000, don't tell anybody. So, and, you know, so it was like a giant pilot in many ways. So they, like, when we were going to do number two, and he was going to come to the studio, he and I would hang out, and we would, like, he and Kamiyama was there, too, and we would listen to, like, they had this radio show where Miyazaki got on the radio show, and he was, I don't know, he's really crotchety that day, really cranky.
That day?
Yeah, well, I know. He was on there, and he just, this guy asked him some questions, and he was really not happy with these questions, and he says, and so he talked about, like, Nausicaa, and Mononoke was just coming out at that time. He said, yeah, you do a lot of things, like, about the Earth and ecology, and he cuts him off. He goes, I don't want people calling me Ecology Oji-san, Uncle Ecology. I don't want that, because it's not true. I'm like, ha ha ha. So, and we're laughing, so we're bonding over this kind of silly stuff. So, and he and I got together, we went to see some midnight movies, you know, like all sorts of different stuff, and I went to his house a few times, and we went to a con in the U.S. together. We went to Anime Expo together one time, I don't remember what year that was. So when he came to Thailand, you know, we're buddies. We're like, hey, let's go eat weird stuff. Let's go. We had a dog at our studio, and there's all these nasty rabid mangy dogs on the street who would just, you know, steal any food they could get. And so they took out one, our dog was a puppy from them, and my staff raised it, and he was this little fat thing. And he got out on the street, and they bit part of his upper cheek thing. I don't know what you call it. His upper lip. They took this big notch out of his upper lip so you could see his teeth. It looked like it was really kind of terrifying looking. Because on one side he'd be like this cute dog, he turns his head and it's like horror. And I'm like, oh, how the look, it's horror dog. And he was so fascinated by this. He sat there and like really spent a lot of time with our dog Gutti. And you know, and man, Thailand is I mean, you can get like magazines where there's like, you know, fashion on the front and fashion on the back, and in the middle is full of crime scene photos, like murders and suicides and like close-ups of all this stuff. And, you know, obviously he liked that, so we would hunt those down. And, you know, if you really know, you can find bodies in the street if you really, at that time, if you really knew your stuff. And so, yeah, we had many interesting adventures. One time I took him and Kamiyama to this this Pakistani restaurant. And I love me some Pakistani food. It tends to be a little hotter than Indian food. So we went in and I said, how much spice can y'all take? And they're like, oh, we can take anything. I'm like, really? Okay. When the guy came to take our order, he said, how hot do you want? I said, make it like you make it at home. And we were crying. Our faces were, it was amazing. It was the best food. So good, but we were dying. And so we walked out of there, and Ohata's like, I think I'm on fire. It's just, yeah, just all sorts of stuff, like the Kamiyama too, man. It was so good, though. But, yeah, so we did that. We went all over shopping and went on, I think we went on the river, and, you know, just adventuring like that. It was a lot of fun.
Wild bohemian days.
Yeah, also, he when he was at my studio, he, you know, he was writing and doing storyboards for Geno Cyber 3. And, like, we got to talking about it, because the original ending of it, oh, my God, it was completely hopeless. And I asked him, I said, you know, let me ask you this. I mean, so we get to the ending. Well, why did I watch all three episodes of this? And then, so this happens, this happens, and everything's, it's over, tough poo-poo to everything. I'm like, well, that I wouldn't watch it again. I wouldn't want to buy it. I mean, it's like, oh, that's really depressing. I mean, and it's not like something where, you know, it's a tour de force like Requiem for a Dream or something like that. You know, it's a horror story, basically, science fiction horror story. So we got to talking about it, and he did change the ending. I mean, not that I didn't write the ending. I didn't, you know, say, oh, do this or whatever. But, you know, we did talk about it. And my thing was, you know, having some kind of hope in the ending would be good. And so he did change it. So it kind of has hope after the blood-sucking leeches or whatever they are. So, yeah. So, you know, little influence there. We were friends.
I love Jonas Cypher.
It's always interesting when every so often, every few years, somebody will pop up who really likes it. Like last year, I went to a con in Chicago and there was a guy who loved Geno Cyber, and he contacted me and he asked me all these really detailed questions, and I loved it. It was like, oh my gosh, I haven't talked about this in a long time.
the nihilism and the misanthropy appeals to me.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Yes. Yes.
All right, got a couple here from V-Guy. He asks, he says he's seen interviews in which you said that some Americans, or maybe most, have stereotypical views of Japan, thinking that it's just like America with minor differences, and not understanding that's a completely different cultural value set, and that anime might not represent this very well.
Yes.
We just had Carl Horn on, and he said that... he said, and shocker, this is leading into an Evangelion question. He said that...
oh, I won't even start on Eva.
Well, he said that many in Japan felt that Evangelion was amazing because it captured the spirit of Japan in the 90s. And he wants to know, do you feel it's possible to understand Japanese culture through anime?
I think it's possible to understand elements of it. You know, I mean, for instance, Evangelion, well... it's a picture of one part of Japan in the 90s, youth culture, but it's not a picture of people in their 70s. It's not a picture of, you know, people in the Yakuza. It's not a picture of people who work at the Ramenya, you know. I mean, it's a picture of a mood of a kind of a subset of people. So, you know, it's just like you can't watch one American movie that defines America. It's the same thing. So, but I think you can definitely learn about certain elements. I've watched this movie called Ramen Girl with some friends, and I had that was quite the schooling on ramen. You know, Taunpopo was about food too. So you can learn definitely about bits and pieces, but until you go there, until you have a grasp of the language, which is how the people think, how they relate to each other, how they relate to the world, and until you have breathed it and lived it and been forced into it, you know, having to, you know, figure out how to get food and stuff like that. The immersion is a whole different level. And that's how you become fluent in the culture. But I think you can learn a great deal about some elements of it through anime. You know, and like I was just saying, I mean, obviously there's lots of anime that teaches cooking, golf, everything. So yeah, certainly you could. There was, when I first moved, there was Nihon Keizai Nyumon, which is the introduction to the Japanese economy. And I learned a lot. I mean, I didn't understand a lot, but I learned a lot from that. And that obviously taught me about some Japanese business, about Japanese executive management. So certainly.
Okay. And finally, from V-Guy, wants to know, he sort of begins with an anecdote. He says he's heard that Oshii, Mamoru Oshii, had to use CGI in Skycrawlers because there weren't enough animators in Japan left to do it. And we've heard sobering reports that a brain drain is happening in Japanese animation, shipping the grunt work overseas on the cheap, which means a new rising generation of Japanese animators doesn't get entry-level experience.
Yes, same thing happened here.
Right. Yeah. So from that, do you think the brain drain is worse now than ever, or are there signs of returning health?
The problem is the economy, and the brains are going to go where they get fed the best. It really is. And anime is one of the worst feeders out there. So the brain drain is going to continue. And there are obviously people who are really dedicated. It's their life, and they're going to stay. I can't speak for Skycrawlers. I've watched it, but I didn't know. I don't know that much about the production of it. And it is possible. But the trick with this is the key animators. Because you can teach in-betweeners really easy. I can train in-betweeners in like 2 months to do whatever. But a key animator, that's life experience. I mean, you really have to know your stuff to do that. And so because so much work got shipped overseas to, you know, Thailand too, to India, to Indonesia, to all sorts of different places, which, you know, I've worked on it there too, though we didn't have many in-betweeners. We lost cell departments. We'd have just supervisors of those things. And so in order to be a supervisor, you have to come from somewhere. And so suddenly we didn't have the experience to have supervisors or key animators or stuff. I know they're going through that right now. Because the United States, that happened in the 90s, when everything, in the 80s, when everything went to Korea and then later to China, Taiwan too, that radically changed everything. So there were no in-betweeners anymore. So when the key animators would leave, there was nobody to replace them. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Is that a good answer?
I think so. I think that gives us a pretty good picture. Okay, well, this has all been extremely fascinating and fun, and we cannot thank you enough for
my apologies for rambly.
Oh, no, it's great. That was fantastic. I'm sure our listeners will just love it. So thank you so much for coming by.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Jan for stopping by. Theme song is Bucharest by the band The New Division. You can find them at thenewdivision.net. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes while you're there. Leave us a rating, a little review. We'd really appreciate it. And we will see you all next week.